I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Linguist John McWhorter wants to change the conversation about race. He begins his new book, Woke Racism, with a description of what the book is not about. It is not, he writes, an argument against protest or the left or a book of complaints or a book written for right-wing America. In fact, he says he wrote the book for an NPR listening audience and for Black people, quote, under the misimpression that cries of weakness constitute a kind of strength. The problem, as McWhorter sees it, is a form of anti-racism that's become a new religion with its high clergy, its scripture, its original sin, and its heretics. He believes that it doesn't advance the cause of civil rights, in fact, ends up hurting Black people. John McWhorter is Associate Professor of Linguistics at Columbia University. He writes a biweekly column for the New York Times about race and language and joins us on Radio Times. John McWhorter, nice to have you with us back on the show.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. You know, I've never read a book that begins with the author telling me, the reader, what this book is not about. Was that you anticipating criticism or being misunderstood or somehow misquoted?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because I think that to the extent that people know me, I'm often thought of as a Black Republican conservative for very understandable reasons, because I do have opposition to a lot of what is thought of as default opinions about what Black America needs. But I'm not conservative. I'm not Republican. And I didn't write the book to play to that particular audience. And so I just wanted to get that part out of the way. I wanted people to not think that this was another one of my books where a certain kind of Black person is likely to despise it and think that I'm writing it in order to, you know, curry favor with Fox News. This is a very pro-Black book, and it's written out of a sense that Black people are being hurt in the name of something that people think of as the latest solution to all problems.
Well, I want to pick up on several things, but let me just quote you. You say your argument is with a, quote, particular strain of the left that has come to exert a grievous amount of influence over American institutions. You do name a number of people, Ta-Nehisi Coates being one of them. Who and what is this strain of left that you have this argument with?
Well, my issue is not with the left in general, because I actually consider myself part of the left. I'm a good liberal circa 1960 and maybe about 10 years beyond. My problem with a strain of the left that thinks of radical leftist perspectives as the default, as the only constructive, the only moral way to think about what Black America needs. And specifically, there's a strain of that kind of person who feel that if you don't agree with their way of looking at things, then you should be expelled. You should be tormented. You should be stripped of your honors. You should lose your job. You're not fit for polite company. You need to be shut out. And specifically, you need to be called a white supremacist on Twitter. That modus operandi, I think, is really dangerous, because the truth is we've made a whole lot more progress on race in America than a lot of us like to think. And one evidence of it is that people would almost rather be called pedophiles than racists these days. It's one of the very worst things you could be, in a way that wasn't true even as late as the 1980s. But that means that for many people, being called a white supremacist on Twitter is such an unthinkable horror that they'll pretend to agree with hard leftist solutions to Black America's problems that aren't even solutions and that actually end up hurting Black people, despite what people suppose. I'm worried that enlightened America is basically living under a kind of a reign of terror of that kind of person calling them names and allowing Black people to not get the help that Black people need.
Well, let me quote you again. You write, you get the first wave anti-racism and think of segregation as an ancient barbarity. You are right. You get the second wave, and we should think that all should, and think that we should all work to truly see Black people as equal to whites and deserving of all that whites get, and you are right. Then you write about this third wave anti-racism, telling you that you are morally bound to conceive of ordinary statements that once were thought of as progressive, like, I don't see color, as racist, that if you are white, you are to despise yourself as tainted permanently by white privilege in everything you do. Let me pick up on the third thing, especially about white people. I'm a white person myself. And mm-hmm. I think of, you know, white supremacy is real. Not all whites are supremacists, but many whites, myself included, have benefited from white supremacy. Help us sort of help us grapple with that.
Well, that's true. And now what? That's the thing. We talk about that too much these days. Yes, white people have benefited from white supremacy. Yes, there is what's called systemic racism. I don't deny it at all. But the question is, what now? There are black people who need help. And as far as I'm concerned, no offense, but white people sitting around talking about how they know that they're privileged doesn't do anything for, say, a single mom who has kids and has trouble holding a job because she can't find decent child care. There's no connection. Now, a lot of people seem to think that if we're going to solve these problems first, we have to have white people truly understanding how supreme they are. There has to be this understanding. And I say, who says? Because the Civil Rights Revolution in the 50s and 60s did not require whites to be so superbly aware. And you might think, well, okay, but if we're going to get further, then we have to have whites really understand, because somehow that's going to translate into legislation in the sclerotic Congress that we see how it doesn't follow. The truth is, there is a strain of person who is focusing on this business of having everybody think about white supremacy, not in order to help real people who need help, but because it feels good to talk about those things and think about those things and think about your higher awareness. There's a disconnect that I think really is a problem, because it has nothing to do with grassroots activism. People think there's a connection between the two, but you notice how little you hear it specified just what that connection is and how it's going to help actual people. This is dangerous. It's a detour.
But doesn't awareness, I mean, hopefully lead to things like responsibility? And maybe you can't, you know, solve the problem of racial inequality, but maybe you can vote a certain way or take a look at what's happening, for instance, with voting rights and see that as a way to try to get to this equality that hopefully we all want.
Sure. You have to work on the fact that people are trying to deny black people the vote. However, I don't see how it's going to lift the wings of that effort for people to sit around and think about how white privilege is an eternal stain and something that you have to always think about, and how you have to think of yourself as complicit within a system that was built for you, et cetera. Why is it that we suppose that white people need to think that way in order to go out into society and do the right things, including voting the right way? And some people will say, well, it certainly doesn't hurt, but to what extent is it helping? And why devote so much energy to this mind training, to these artful uses of words, and also to throwing people out of windows when they disagree, when really you could put the same energy into being out on the ground, doing the things that civil rights leaders did in the past and that many of them are still doing? It doesn't strike me as hard work that way.
Well, let me pick up on something else you say in the book, which is this form of anti-racism that you really equate to a religion. And my understanding, John McWhorter, you're an atheist, so you're not, you know, you don't believe in I guess a higher power, but nonetheless, help us understand then how this has become a religion from your perspective.
Well, what I mean by it being a religion is partly that the way people who disagree are treated is as heretics, not as somebody who disagrees, but there's a notion that you shouldn't be in the room, that person shouldn't have their job. The person has to be excommunicated, put in the stocks. That's a religious kind of behavior. There are great things about religion. There are bad things about some religions. And that's one of the bad parts. Religion also can involve suspension of disbelief. There are questions that you're just not supposed to ask. You're supposed to have faith, for example, when that can be very difficult. Some people believe in miracles. But more to the point, there's a place where logic is no longer germane and you're supposed to just have faith and go with a different way of cogitating, so to speak. That's what goes on with modern anti-racism, too. There are questions you aren't supposed to ask. There are things that would make no sense if we rolled the tape backwards and did things again. And so, for example, a very quick example.
Sure.
There are white cops who kill black men. That happens, and they are grievous events. And we all know that George Floyd was just the tip of the iceberg. But then in the communities that those black men often come from, they're at much more of a risk of being killed by somebody from within the community. And in fact, every summer in many big cities, including Philadelphia, you have an epidemic of young black men killing one another. Why are we more upset about, say, Derek Chauvin than what happens in those communities. And it's not that people aren't upset about what happens in those communities, but notice that the white cop concerns us much, 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 much more. Why? Given that the mother who loses the son feels equally bad whether it was done by a stray white cop or by somebody who everybody knew in the neighborhood. Why is the white cop more of a problem? Because this is a religion. It's all about showing that you know racism exists. Never mind helping the people who are of a race. The idea is just for you to show that you know that there are these racist disparities and that racism exists. So we're more upset about Derek Chauvin than about what young black men in underserved communities are at much more danger of being harmed by. It's weird. That's a religious way of thinking, in that for me to even mention this, for me to even ask the question, will get many eyes rolling. I just don't get it. But what don't I get? And that's what I mean by this is not just logical A to B to C thinking. It's a creed. It's mystical in ways.
Well, picking up on that, and you're absolutely right, the problem of gun violence here in Philadelphia is at epidemic proportions. We've done numerous shows, and we've talked to those mothers that you talk about who have lost children to gun violence. So when you talk about the anti-racists, is this within academia? Is this what is being argued in academia, or is it filtered down, to the rest of us?
Yeah, it used to be something that you mainly encountered in academic circles. And there was a time when there was a great outcry about campuses being taken over by tenured radicals. And that was not the case. I was being a professor in the 90s, and I remember thinking that tenured radical is an interesting kind of person who contributes to the discussion, but they're not taking over the campus. But this is not about college campuses. I happen to be a professor, but I'm not just writing about what goes on where I work. This has taken over America's thinking culture in general and beyond. What worries me is that a religion, and I mean literally a religion, I don't mean that it's like a religion, it is a religion. An anthropologist who was very naive would see no difference between this new religion and the thing that we happen to call religion. So religion is taking over the way we think, the way we're told to make judgments, the way we're told to view morality. It's taking over the arts. It's completely taking over what many people would consider part of the soul of who we are. Notice I'm not going to say some corny thing about America, et cetera. Just who we are. The life that we were leading in, say, 2019 is being turned upside down by a perspective that most people, white or black, do not agree with. But we knuckle under because we're afraid to be called racists on Twitter. I think it's a very sad state of affairs.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about Twitter. I also want to talk about critical race theory, cancel culture. And again, John McWhorter is our guest today on Radio Times. He's associate professor of linguistics at Columbia University. He writes about race and language for the New York Times, and he's got a new book called Woke Racism, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. And he also wrote a book that we couldn't interview him on Radio Times not so long ago called 9 Nasty Words. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss. Cohen talking with linguist John McWhorter. He wants to change the conversation about race. He's got a new book of Woke Racism, and he argues that policing language has taken precedence over political activism, and he has some ideas about how to rethink the conversation about race. You can join us. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. John McWhorter, you talked about, what you find on Twitter. And, I always feel like, Twitter is just where people go to fight. And it's hard to take what is said on Twitter, even though it does have some consequences in certain instances, to take it seriously as if that's really the way people are talking about race. Am I wrong?
No, I think that the main issue is it may seem mundane. However much we consider Twitter to be a real place or not, Nobody wants to be called a white supremacist on it because everybody can see. It's the equivalent of somebody having a megaphone out in the public square and calling you a white supremacist. And that really deeply scares a lot of people. And so it could be on Twitter. It could be on other social media. But the fact that we have these devices that allow somebody to shout so loudly for even a minor provocation really does change our existence. This wouldn't be a problem before roughly 2009. But now that we have this thing called Twitter and this thing called Facebook, you can smear people's reputations very easily. And we're not going to get rid of the social media, but we have to learn that, frankly, this is something that comes later in the book, but I say we need to learn how to be called racist on social media and walk on. I feel sorry for white people sometimes because white people have gone through learning that being a racist is a bad thing. And it seems to me that that was very hard for a lot of white people to accept, despite the fact that it was correct. And so there's that. Now there's a new thing, and black people need to do this too, which is if somebody calls you a white supremacist on Twitter for something that you didn't do, for something that you didn't mean, then that should not be considered the end of your life. You need to learn how to walk on, because otherwise a certain kind of person who has a certain kind of, frankly, I think, inwardly focused vision of how to, quote unquote, help black people ends up ruling the day just because everybody else is afraid.
How do you walk on if you lose your job? You tell a story about a data analyst, a guy named David Shore, who wrote some things. I don't know if it was on Twitter, but he wrote some things and he lost his job.
Yeah, and David Shore is now working again and is more famous than he was at the time. His life continued. Now, of course, some people are in a better position to stand up against these things than others. If you're going to lose your job and you're not likely to get another one, of course, you might have to just pay to play. But I think all of us should help create an environment where the kind of person I call in the book the elect cannot get their way just by standing up and shouting and calling you a name on Twitter. To the extent that you can resist that climate in any way, it's very important, because otherwise a religion is going to take over the entire way that we've been doing things here.
How do you define critical race theory?
Critical race theory itself, I have a piece on that in the Times coming up today, come to think of it, because it's become a mess. Critical race theory originally is some legal doctrine written by some very brilliant people decades ago. Now, critical race theory of that kind is not being taught in any classroom that I can imagine, but the term has evolved, the concept has evolved. There are ways of approaching education that are descended from the tenets of those original papers that are definitely making their way into classrooms. And it's the basic idea that whites are the oppressors and black people are the oppressed, and that white and black people should think about that more than they do and should be trained to think about it when they're children, that battling power differentials, and especially ones based on skin color, should be central to how you learn how to think about anything, including art, rather than just one of, say, six or seven things that you're thinking about as you get in education. And the general idea that there should be this sense of the races in opposition, that this is something that one should think about. So the issue is not learning about slavery. The issue is not learning that racism exists. That's fine. That should be part of an education. But it's this particular menacing us against them and, frankly, reductive view of American history and America's present that is being directed into a great many curricula in a great many school districts. So it's not critical race theory as in what Kimberly Crenshaw and Derek Bell wrote. Anybody who says,
and those are the academics, yes.
Right. Nobody's teaching that. No 10-year-old could even understand it. It's what has descended from it, which is also called CRT because language is sloppy. But yeah, we're having a very messy debate over that at this point.
Well, let me pick up on something. And oftentimes, and CRT gets us into this idea of systemic racism. Oftentimes people point to redlining, which was a way of discriminating against black people moving into largely white neighborhoods. I actually downloaded a covenant from the Levittowns, which were, of course, built in the 1940s and 50s. Here's the covenant. The tenant agrees not to permit the premises to be used or occupied by any person other than members of the Caucasian race, but the employment and maintenance of other than Caucasian domestic servants shall be permitted. Now, having a home is one way that someone creates generational wealth. If you are denied a house in Levittown because you are black, how do we teach that in our schools?
Teach it. That happened. That is something that people should know. If you want to do a 2.0 version of it, what people don't talk about is that if you went back in time and you walked around in a redlined neighborhood, most of the people who lived in those neighborhoods were white. You don't talk about that. And so when I say that we tend to oversimplify these things, that is a fact. More white people lived in those neighborhoods. But maybe that's too much. But yes, redlining happened, and it disproportionately affected black people. That was real. And that means that starting in, say, the 1970s, you might talk about reparations. And the thing is, we did. And so today, I think there's one approach to that, which is to say, well, black people deserve to be paid back for what happened there. And in Evanston, Illinois, there's even a program where black people are given a break on mortgages. And I understand that. But the idea that there haven't been reparations already, when that's exactly what affirmative action is, that's exactly what the Community Reinvestment Act of 19, I am not caffeinated, and so I can't remember the year, but 1970-something, sometime in the early 70s, all the scholarships that we've had, various programs, including the way welfare was administrated after 1966. Nobody called it reparations, just like today we're calling it critical race theory when somebody is taught that, you know, white people are not to be trusted in classes. Language is sloppy. Nobody was calling it reparations then, but I think it already happened. And so that's my perspective on that sort of, but yeah. Redlining, that's something that people should be taught. There's nothing hostile about the fact itself.
My understanding with certainly in the early days of affirmative action, it was white women who were the beneficiaries, largely.
Well, the issue is this. If affirmative action has largely benefited white women, then why is it that whenever it's under threat, everybody representing black people howls as if our thumb was being pulled backwards? Affirmative action, whatever the original intent, whatever the original effect, had a profound effect on the black community. And frankly, it made a lot of my life, I was born in 1965, possible. And affirmative action is a whole different issue, but it wasn't instituted for women. It was instituted as a racial policy and then was extended to women because of various political machinations that I don't think we have time to talk about. But that was a pro-black policy and it worked.
Well, let me quickly introduce you, and I want to circle back to something we were talking about earlier, because a couple of our listeners are taking issue with both you and me, John McWhorter. We are talking with John McWhorter. He is a linguist. He's also a columnist for The New York Times, where he writes about language and race, and he's got a new book. It's called Woke Racism, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me read two emails, one from Bill. He says, when a black person kills another person in their community, it's usually because of a personal or territorial conflict. When a white police officer kills a black person, it is a symbol of societal oppression. That's why many find it more worthy of attention and outrage. Lisa adds to that, Marty, I'm disappointed that you let his comment go unchecked. What is the difference between Derek Chauvin and black-on-black crime? Why do we make a bigger deal out of the former? Do you really believe the two are equivalent? Derek Chauvin is in a position of authority. There is a huge difference. And I agree with our listeners. What do you say, John McWhorter?
I'm not sure I understand. I'm thinking about that black mother. And I understand the abstraction of the fact that Derek Chauvin is state-sanctioned. Yeah, I understand that.
Right.
But in terms of what's a problem for black people living their lives, is Derek Chauvin and what he does more of a problem than what goes on in the community? And I'm afraid it isn't. I'm thinking about the mother as opposed to taking this bird's eye view and thinking about how grievous it is that there are people who are paid to walk around with guns who do certain things. The thing is, what they do, as terrible as it is something that threatens the black person living in an underserved community much, 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 much less than the other thing. I just think that we should be equally concerned and, frankly, more concerned about the other thing because it hurts black people so deeply. I'm not sure why that's considered a renegade view.
I'm not sure that it is, but I appreciate the comments from our listeners. Isn't it also true, John McWhorter, that whites kill white people? I mean, that we sort of kill our own.
Sure. Now, in the summer in Philadelphia, I hate to put it this way.
And you grew up in Philadelphia, correct?
I did. So in this case, you know, I even know what neighborhoods we're talking about. When you read the news, when you open up the Inquirer, not the Inquirer, the Inquirer, and you read about some boys who, you know, killed each other over the weekend. What color are they? And there's a whole conversation that we can have about why. But yes, people kill people of their own color. But we have a problem with how many people of our own color kill each other. Or that is going to go on in the black neighborhood than, say, in the white neighborhood, including all of the white neighborhoods. I mean, frankly, I know Fishtown, Kensington, et cetera. And we have a problem. And the issue is not pointing fingers and, you know, pathologizing people. There are reasons for all of these things. But they concern me deeply. Why do so many black kids start killing each other every summer? I want to work on that. So do many people. But to me, that is equally a problem as Derek Chauvin, you know, Darren Wilson, et cetera.
So
I stand by that.
Why do you think that happens?
You know, there is a cocktail involved. It's partly that the war on drugs was instituted and deprived too many black boys of dads. It makes that sort of thing more likely. There's a whole issue with how easy it is to get a gun in this country. That is another problem. And then there is a war on drugs that creates an incentive for gangs to have wars. You know, a lot of those turf wars are over who's going to sell where. That's a problem. We are a country who, since World War II, has fetishized the idea that real people go to college instead of making vocational school much easier for people to get and thrive in if they decide they don't want to go to college. We should be more like Germany in that way. All of those things come together, and they disproportionately affect black people. Also, there's a whole story about welfare legislation starting in about 1966 and how welfare administration stopped caring whether anybody got job training. That ripped a hole in black communities across the country, including Philadelphia. And so you have that situation now, and the question is, what do you do about it? And frankly, if the answer to that question, if you look at all those boys killing each other and all those parents sobbing, et cetera, and you think racism, well, frankly, that is so abstract that, with all due respect to anybody who's thinking it, I can't help wondering how much you care. Racism may have created all of this stuff to an extent, although social history is complicated. But what you do about it now might not be eliminating racism. Racism might not still be acting upon those kids. And so that's the issue. I think more people are interested, it seems, in a certain class, in thinking about Derek Chauvin because that means you're thinking about racism. The other problem is less attractive because it doesn't seem to be as much about racism, not that you can actually get your hands on. I'm trying to pull the camera because I think we need to think about real people rather than abstractions.
I wonder, too, and you described the war on drugs and its effect on so many black families and black communities. And I wonder, too, also how we viewed cocaine, whether it was crack cocaine or powder cocaine,
yeah,
and how the law saw those in two very different ways. And, you know, who was using crack cocaine? Largely black communities. Who was using powder cocaine? Largely white communities. And the differential was profound.
Yeah, that was wrong. And that's something that needs to be acknowledged. You might want to teach that in school. But the problem is, the idea that that was only about racism doesn't work in that very, very concerned black people all over the country were behind those laws at the time. Now, if you talk to them now, they say they didn't know what the effect would be. And I completely understand that. But imagine that it was, you know, these cigar-chomping white people who penned those laws thinking we're going to hurt those black boys because we don't like what they're doing. So let's tilt it this way. There were black ministers, there were Maxine Waters types standing by those people smiling when the pen was hitting the paper. We tend to forget that because it was a while ago now. But the focus on racism often is an oversimplification. It's not that it doesn't exist. but there's an orthogonal, there's a diagonal relationship off between wanting to battle racism and wanting to change lives of people living day-to-day existences, especially in dangerous places.
What do you think of, this is almost ancient history, but nonetheless, Hillary Clinton talked about super predators. How did you understand that, especially as a linguist?
You know what? That's one of those things. Okay, that wasn't the most graceful thing to say, but I'm much more interested in what's going on in those communities for the people, not to be monotonous, than this issue of a word that she used, this language policing. Frankly, telling people not to say things doesn't change what they think. There was an the focus on that, I think, was misplaced. More energy should have been put into what policies Hillary Clinton was proposing and whether or not, just as Jewish people often say good for the Jews, whether or not her policies were good for black people, not a word she used once. I was aggrieved to see that Black Lives Matter movement member, you know, basically pinning her and grilling her about her use of that word eons ago, instead of being concerned with whether her policies were pro-black, whether she was in a position to intelligently address problems that she was very much aware of. That's a problem these days. That's the religion. The religion is that you prosecute people for using the wrong terms. That's nice, but in the meantime, there's a real world out there.
Well, let me read some more comments, and we'll take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Gary writes, thank you, John McWhorter. Your perspective is welcome and should be more widely discussed. As a traditional liberal, the religion of the left, the far left woke movement is scaring me and many on the left and on the right. A comment from Olivia, this subject is long overdue. Even if the origins were well-intended, this type of zealotry is detrimental to society. Extremism in any form divides us. At the very least, it's worth noting that this is fueling the radical right. We are talking with John McWhorter. He's got a new book, it's titled Woke Racism, and it's subtitled How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. He did grow up here in Philadelphia, and he writes a column for the New York Times about language and about race. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We're also going to make sure that you can continue our conversation as well. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, John McWhorter is our guest. He's a linguist. And he writes books. His newest one is called Woke Racism, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. John McWhorter, let me try something out on you, because I was thinking about critical race theory and how it is misunderstood. It is sort of applied in various ways, sort of in probably ways that we might not recognize in schools, whether it's sort of a follow-up to the fight about evolution in schools, about teaching intelligent design, or maybe even sex ed in schools. These certain issues that just galvanize people, get people at each other's throats, and it's not always clear we're always talking and arguing about the same thing.
Yeah, I think with that particular debate, a lot of people on the left think that white people want education to be in denial about race. I think they think that people are saying, stop stirring all that stuff up. Don't have anybody read Toni Morrison. Don't talk about slavery. Let's just pretend that we're past it. The thing is, I'm not sure how many of these people are saying that. It's easy to suppose that that's what people are saying because, I hate to say this, it gives you a sense that you're battling racism. But what I hear a lot of parents saying is, teach about slavery and racism, sure, but don't teach it in a way that's designed to train the students to be set against one another and to think of the whole American experiment as having been a kind of a crime spree. And the thing is, some people on the left think that what I just said is the way people ought to be taught. But they need to realize that not all people do, crucially, that if you don't, that doesn't make you a racist. It might make you different from them. Now, I'm unaware of a critical mass of people who are saying, don't talk about the hard stuff in school at all. It's something more specific. And that's where I think the debate ends up getting messy.
How do you feel about the 1619 Project?
1619. Well, you know, a lot of it is just good work. The central tenet that the Revolutionary War was fought over slavery is quite simply incorrect. And I think if we had a more honest discussion, then that would not be considered a controversial thing to say beyond certain circles. I was disappointed by the idea that to put that out there, even when it's been refuted, is considered valid just because of the identity of the person who put it there. But the 1619 Project, most of it is just history. But you don't want to teach myths. That general idea that you want to teach kids that America has been this polluted, fake experiment from the very beginning and that really we ought to blow it all up and start again, that is a view that some people have. That is not a consensus even among educated, enlightened people. And we shouldn't be forced to pretend it is out of a fear of being told that we're white supremacists if we disagree with it.
Well, the New York Times actually changed the wording that the people, were, including you, were taking issue with so that, and I'll read here, conveniently left out of our founding mythology is the fact that one of the primary reasons some of the colonists decided to declare their independence from Britain was because they wanted to protect the institution of slavery. So going from, you know, the to one of the, does that satisfy you as a linguist?
No. I mean,
why not?
To be honest, from what I have read, and I am stepping outside of my expertise here, and so I could be wrong, but from what I've read, it was a motivation to so few people that it would be a rather peculiar thing to put in bold print in a historical account that lots of people are supposed to read. That's my impression. But this is the crucial thing about it. Even if I'm wrong about that, the Times changed it. But the Times changed it quietly, as opposed to there being an open, you know, acknowledgement.
You know, I'm looking at a headline here, and, you know, headlines can be misleading, but nonetheless, a Texas lawmaker is targeting 850 books that he says could make students feel uneasy. And this is from the other side, you know, looking at books that that probably have a more conservative cast to the story. Using that as an example, how do we teach difficult history?
You know, there's going to be a fine line there, because what some people will consider history, you know, unpleasant things, some people will consider stirring things up that children don't need to be exposed to. And so, for example, I don't know where I would come down on, say, Beloved, which is a magnificent book, but it's also a scary book.
Terrifying.
There have been some people who had trouble with kids being given that. Now, some people say, well, that's racism because Beloved is about some truths. But Beloved is also really deep and really frightening. And I think a person might feel that to combine race with that is something that they don't want their children exposed to. And I'm not sure I could call that person a racist. There's an intelligent discussion you could have there. But, for example, should kids be taught about the Tulsa riots? Yes. Should kids be taught that America has been all about cigar-chomping white people and nothing else from the very beginning, and liberalism and the Enlightenment are just fake things that are designed to shore up white power? No, that is not what people should be taught in seventh grade, whatever the wording is. And I don't think that makes me a white supremacist. I think it gives me a certain sense on what people should know at what point in time, and the difference between consensus and opinion. And I'm not sure people are always thinking about that.
Right. My understanding, and I agree with you about Beloved, it's a very difficult book to read and very important. My understanding is that it was AP, you know, advanced placement students. I'm not justifying it one way or the other, but it's not like it was, you know, for ninth grade class.
Right. Yeah. So these things are tough. One of the hardest things is that there's a certain kind of person who thinks that they've hit upon truth. I can really see that they think that they are bringing joy and enlightenment and justice to the world at last. They think they have found it. But you notice that sounds kind of like a religious way of thinking. And like many people who think that way, they figure that if you're going to make an omelet, you've got to crack some eggs. And so, of course, people are going to get hurt. Things are going to be messy, as a lot of people put it. But I'm not sure that this solution to everything is what it's cracked up to be. and we need to question it. I feel like there are people who have a perspective, and it's a valid one. Mm-hmm. To me, it's valid when it's placed among other perspectives. But they feel that they've got the truth, and we pretend that we agree with them because they call us names if we don't. That's not the way a mature society operates, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me read a couple more comments. A tweet from Virginia. I totally agree with the religious aspect. This is happening in the gender ideology debate as well. I don't want to get too off target, but do you see that as well, John McWhorter, when it comes to issues of race, not race, but like sex and gender?
You know, I pick my battles. Right. It's hard enough being a quote unquote contrarian about race. And, you know, I just now stepped outside of being a linguist and pretended to be a historian.
Right.
There's only so much I can say when it comes to the sex and gender issues, but I would also be being fake if I didn't say that I see very strong parallels. The idea that there's only one way to think as opposed to people putting out their opinion.
But interestingly, though, you have written about pronouns. I mean, personally speaking, I find it challenging and fascinating that we're seeing pronouns changing and people using they and trying to understand what gender and sexual identity means to someone. Again, back. Mm-hmm. And you have written about this, John McWhorter, and you seem to embrace it as well.
Oh, yeah. The whole issue of the language making space for people who are non-binary, that makes perfect sense to me. It strikes me as enlightenment. The new way of using they is challenging, you know, especially if you're, you know, over a certain age, but I am enjoying trying to learn how to do it. That's great. But then, you know, I don't want to go too far into it because it's not the same. But the way Dave Chappelle was treated a couple weeks ago, for example, yeah. It seems that there are religious aspects that worry me. The basic idea that if someone says something that you don't like, and it's about power differentials, it's related to differentials in power, then that person should be treated as a heretic. That person should be treated as if they have committed a major moral sin. That's hard. It used to be that you got yelled at. You know, people are going to get yelled at. Things
sure.
are definitely going to be messy. But the idea that you are polluted, that you are Hitler, that's the problem. There's an extremism that social media and especially the racial reckoning after George Floyd has promoted. And I think a lot of it also had to do with the fact that all of life was on Zoom. The chat room created a great deal of this in a way that I think historians are going to document. But it's not the way a mature society operates. But for me, I try to stick with the race issue because I feel it personally and it's what I pay the most attention to. But yes, it is a subset of a larger attitude about battling power differentials, how you do it, and what it's supposed to mean.
Let me go back to some of our listeners here. Roman tweeted, critical race theory has two meanings, but why lie about the new meaning by saying that language evolves? We know this new usage is deliberate right-wing propaganda. And I think what he's getting at is, and I wonder, you know, so I was in doing my homework to interview you, John McWhorter, you know, I could look at Tucker Carlson, who, at least on paper, has some of the same arguments that you have.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was about to make a snarky remark, and I'm not going to
okay.
do it. But yes,
you can if you want to, but that's okay.
No, there are certainly people on the right who are trying to take advantage. That is true. However, is most of what the opposition to CRT, as it is currently being used in classrooms in its modern incarnation, not the original papers, is that most of what the opposition is? When parents say we don't want CRT taught because their 13-year-old said that the teacher taught them that they were white and they should always feel guilty, is that the same thing as some operator who's trying to get ratings or who's trying to stir up nasty feelings in order to get the Republicans more votes? I think it's facile to assume that that is the only thing going on. There's a time when the way people like Howard Zinn wrote can put a straitjacket on our thinking. Everything is not about that us versus them, good versus evil. Frankly, a lot of CRT in both of its manifestations encourages a sense that there are the good people and the bad people. Good black people, bad white people. That's not usually the way things are working. It's usually more complicated than that. And I think we shouldn't try to step away from it just because it feels good to point out racism.
And when you say they, I mean, I mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates, and you mentioned several other people. Is your argument with a handful of people that have, perhaps from your perspective, undue influence on how we talk about race?
Yes. But I'm more concerned with the influence than the people themselves. So, for example, Ta-Nehisi Coates and I have not liked each other for 15 years.
Really? Really?
But, oh, he can't stand me, and so therefore I stopped liking him. But the thing is, I don't think that he is deliberately, you know, out there trying to, you know, mislead minds or something like that. And frankly, he's not as active journalistically as he used to be. What worries me is that there are certain people who are treated not as people with an opinion, but as priests. And of course, I'm talking about Robin DiAngelo and Ibram Kendi. And when their ideas are less questioned than just accepted as scripture, my problem with it is that their ideas hurt black people. That's what woke racism is about. It's not just me complaining about something Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote. It's that if you take their ideas at face value and think of their books as basically testaments of a Bible, which is what I really believe people are thinking of them as, then a lot of black people don't get help because those books are focusing our attention on something that I think is more inwardly directed than anything like the grassroots activism that actually changes lives.
Because it promotes what, grievance or a sense of helplessness?
Well, it means that a white person's job is first to sit and understand their complicitness. And that word is so seductive, complicit. It's even fun to say. Their complicitness in the system. First, you have to do that. Then you go out and do things. So Robin DiAngelo in one book actually
White
says,
Fragility
actually,
is her book.
Yeah,
White Fragility.
Yeah, that's her big book. But then she has others. And she actually says that to think about like societal policy, et cetera, that's hasty. That's solutionism. You're not supposed to do that. First, you have to understand how polluted you are. I don't consider that to be useful politics, nor do I consider it to be useful politics to say there is racism and anti-racism and nothing in between. Boo. No, I don't get it. That doesn't help anybody. So, yeah, these books are, they're appealing, I guess. But I don't think that, I'm going to be really corny here, I don't think Dr. King would recognize them as what was needed to take things to the next level.
What do you think about Stacey Abrams?
She's a god.
A god.
That's what I mean. That is what I mean. You go out and you do stuff. You get out, vote, you talk to people about what the injustice is, and you try to change things. That's what it should be, not sitting around thinking about your complicitness.
What got you to write this book?
Something very trivial, which is that Allison Roman, the food columnist at the New York Times, basically got fired because she said something a little snarky about Chrissy Teigen and Marie Kondo. The idea was she was a white woman who was dissing women of color, as in Chrissy Teigen, who's half Thai, and Marie Kondo, who's a Japanese citizen. When that happened, I thought, wow, not only is this absolutely ridiculous and unjust, and it means that I don't get my recipes, I thought, this is a pattern. This is happening all over the place. This is no longer weird news stories. It was in June 2020. I thought there's this whole new mood of prosecutorial, frankly, nonsense. And I thought, this really bothers me because it's ruining academia. It's ruining the arts. It's ruining our whole sense of how legal theory goes. And I thought, I want to say something. I tend to write my books because I'm mad. That started a long time ago.
I got that.
I got that. Yeah. And I just thought, this really won't do. And, you know, I figured when I first started writing about race, I was like 30, and I was considered too young. A lot of people used to say, well, why should we listen to him? He's going to go get his butt kicked by racism, and then he'll learn. So I thought, well, okay. Now, if I were 75, then I'm too old. You know, I don't know what's really going on. I'm from another time. I thought, I'm in my mid-50s. So now you can't call me a kid, but I'm not elderly either, and I think I'm black. I thought, it needs to be me who writes a book like this. It'll be harder to call me a racist. You know, people are going to call me a white supremacist, but nobody really believes it. And I thought, I just want to get my voice out there on this because I am really seeing harm being done to black people in the name of supposedly helping us. And that's why I wrote it.
Well, John McCorder, we got to leave it there. Thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Woke Racism, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your comments as well. They're still coming in. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.